Hello and welcome to The Hearing, our music review show here on the channel. I'm John.
And from beautiful, sunny, north side of Chicago, I'm Scotto.
Are we going into that whole explanation again? Or?
It's just a record cold day here in Chicago. It's like negative 15 or so, and it was even worse last night, but here we are.
And without any further ado, on to this week's album, which is from 1996, No Code by Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam is an American rock band formed in 1990 in Seattle, Washington, by guitarist guitarist Stone Gossard and bassist Jeff Ament were members of pioneering grunge band Green River during the mid-80s, and in late 87, Gossard and Ament began playing with Malfunction vocalist Andrew Wood, eventually organizing into the band Mother Love Bone.
I was so glad you didn't say, from the ashes of Mother Love Bone, as they always do.
I hopefully have avoided any cliches like that, because I had to edit this together quite a bit. Polygram signed the band in early 89, and Mother Love Bone's debut album, Apple, was released in July of 1990. 4 months later, however, Wood passed away due to a heroin overdose. Ament and Gossard were devastated by the death of Wood, and the resulting demise of Mother Love Bone. Gossard spent his time afterward writing material that was much harder edged than what he'd been doing previously. And after a few months, Gossard began practicing with fellow Seattle guitarist Mike McCready, whose band Shadow had just broken up. McCready, in turn, encouraged Gossard to reconnect with Ament. And after practicing for a while, the trio sent out a 5-song demo in order to find a new singer and drummer. They gave a copy to former Red Hot Chili Peppers drummer Jack Irons, and he passed on it, but he gave the demo to his basketball friend, San Diego singer Eddie Vedder. Vedder listened to the tape shortly before going surfing, where lyrics came to him. He then recorded vocals for 3 of the songs, Alive, Once, and Footsteps, in what he later described as a mini-opera entitled Mama Son.
Yes.
It's been a while since I've listened to 10. I don't remember Footsteps.
The Footsteps did not make it on the album.
Okay, that's why I don't remember it.
But Once...
Once Alive, I know, of course.
Yeah. So it's about a son who's seduced by his mother. That's, you know, Alive.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And he becomes a serial killer in Once.
Ah.
You know, and then he is... Footsteps... is he's caught and he's on his way to the electric chair.
Okay.
And that's the end of the trilogy. They've played it live many times, the three together, but for some reason they didn't want to, I guess, on their debut album, go there.
Right.
Keep in mind, that all happened really quickly. Like, from him getting the tapes, them practicing together...
He sent the tape back with the vocals to the other trio, who were impressed enough to fly him up for an audition. Within a week, Vedder had joined the band.
And then, right, they're playing, pretty much playing with Matt Cameron, who's just like sitting in. Well,
I'm into the drummers now.
Yeah.
Because these guys are the real life Spinal Tap.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they are.
All of the former members are drummers. With the addition of Dave Crewson on drums, the band took on the name Mookie Blaylock in reference to the then active basketball player. They signed
kind of like my affinity for Andy Stankiewicz of the Yankees.
They signed to Epic Records and renamed themselves Pearl Jam. In an early promotional interview, Vedder said that the name Pearl Jam was a reference to his great-grandmother Pearl, who was married to a Native American and had a special recipe for peyote laced jam. But in a 2006 Rolling Stone cover interview, he admitted that the story was total bullshit.
Yeah.
Even though he did have a great grandmother named Pearl, Ament and McCready later explained that Ament came up with Pearl and that the band had settled on Pearl Jam after attending a Neil Young concert in which he extended the songs as improvisations of 15 to 20 minutes in length. So Pearl from it's just the name Pearl and jam sessions. Pearl Jam entered the Seattle London Bridge Studios in March of 91 to record their debut album, 10. McCready said that 10 was mostly Stone and Jeff. Me and Eddie were along for the ride at that time.
Yeah.
Which explains why a lot of people, myself included, like 10 more than their subsequent output. It's a very different album.
Oh, yeah, it is. The production's different. Everything is very different from everything else they've done.
And as I mentioned, it was harder. It's heavier than, you know, it's more of a traditional rock album than a lot of stuff they did.
Post. Oh, definitely. I mean, and it was like the same people that worked with Bowie and Tin Machine were like recording and mastering and producing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Per Aschner and Tim Palmer were the guys that put that album together, which is what got me into it. I was like, oh, I've just been listening to Tin Machine and they're working with this new band. And, you know, there were a lot of things I could hear your similarities on.
And we've boasted this before, but let's just mention it again. We have reason to believe that we were among the first to play Pearl Jam in this area, in my area.
Definitely, yeah.
In the New Jersey
area, definitely.
Yeah. When we were in college radio, we saw, I think, the Alive single is what we had.
Yeah.
And you knew them and you knew of them and played them.
I think we had the single and I saw Per Aschner and Palmer's name on the back.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, let's play this. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, it's like Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison got a band together.
Now onto the drummer saga. Krusen left the band in May of 91 after checking himself into rehab. He was replaced by Matt Chamberlain, who had previously played with Edie Burkell and the New Bohemians.
They actually started with Cameron.
Okay.
Before anybody, before they weren't even sure whether they were going to be a band or not. They just had some music and they wanted to jam. Cameron had some downtime and sat in with them before anything for just like a few weeks.
And Cameron is their current drummer.
Yes.
After Matt Chamberlain, who played a handful of shows, one of them was filmed for the Alive video. So he's in the Alive video. Chamberlain left to join the Saturday Night Live band.
Which is a pretty sweet gig.
Oh, if you can get that gig, take it.
This guy's that hung on there for like what 30 years at least.
I mean, you don't have to tour. You get a damn good paycheck, mm-hmm. and you get to play with a lot of great people. And if you're playing Saturday Night Live, you are at the top of your field.
Right.
Only the best play on that show as the house band anyway. Chamberlain suggested Dave Abruzzese as his replacement. Abruzzese joined the band and played the rest of their live shows supporting 10 and stayed with the band for their next album and most of the third album, Vitology, before being replaced by Jack Irons, who played on No Code, which is Pearl Jam's fourth studio album and the one we'll be reviewing this week.
Yes.
Following a troubled tour for its previous album, Vitology, in which Pearl Jam engaged in a much publicized boycott of Ticketmaster. Anybody who remembers the 90s remembers that.
Yeah.
The band went into the studio to record its follow-up. The music on the record was much more diverse than what the band had done on previous releases, incorporating elements of garage rock and world beat, in the percussion, kind of. Although No Code debuted at number one on the Billboard 200, it left a large section of the band's fan base unsatisfied and quickly fell down in the charts.
Critical reviews. They also didn't promote any of it.
Hmm. Well, they've been underground since the whole Ticketmaster thing.
Yeah. Well, they didn't do videos, which was like, oh my God, you're not doing videos. There were a couple singles from this. One of them, well, when we get to the review, we'll talk about which ones were the singles.
Really, after Versus, which got a shit ton of radio play, they may as well have been independent.
Yeah.
But back to No Code. Critical reviews were mixed, with praise to the musical variety, but the album being considered inconsistent. The album became the first Pearl Jam album not to reach multi-platinum status, receiving single platinum status by the RIAA in the U.S., which is kind of almost a weird, you know, it's kind of like saying, oh, I only have $1 billion.
They were obviously not going for the commercial appeal at this point.
Yeah.
If you didn't get that from Vitology and some of the weird things they were doing on Vitology, this, you know, they were definitely heading off in a different direction.
No Code was released on August 27th, 1996, produced by Brendan O'Brien, who has produced a great number of very, you know, awesome bands, and Pearl Jam, and features Jeff Ament on bass, guitar, Chapman stick. If you don't know what a Chapman stick is, look it up. It's a combination of a guitar and bass with like 10 or 12 strings, and you don't strum or pluck it. You just tap on it. You press down on the frets. Tony Levin from
King Crimson.
Tony Levin. The best Stone player. And guitar on Smile. Stone Gossard, guitar, vocals, piano, and lead vocals on Mankind. I was very surprised to see that.
Yeah.
Jack Irons on drums, Mike McCready on guitar and piano on Sometimes. And, of course, Eddie Vedder, lead vocals, guitar, harmonica, and electric sitar. Seems like he's been playing guitar a lot more lately in subsequent years than he had in the past. Reminder, of course, I don't edit any songs into our episodes for copyright reasons, but down in the description, you'll find links to No Code on Spotify and YouTube. Of course, on to the tracks now. Track one, Sometimes, opens with this very mellow but kind of sinister riff.
Yeah, it's like a boiling beneath the surface kind of, you know?
love hearing Jeff Hammond play fretless bass. He seems to either play fretless or eight string, at least back in the day he did, which I love.
I think it's Ament, by the way.
Hey, Ament. Apologies if I've been mispronouncing that. I love the really soft vocals that came in. I will say this, because this review is not going to be glowing. I'll just say that. But I do appreciate the variety in Vedder's vocals.
Right. It's always strange when you talk about Pearl Jam with people that are non-fans, and they just immediately go to the vocals he did on Even Flow.
Yeah.
Which are really like...
He does have a lot of grip, a lot of variety, but he does pull out the Elvis impression quite a bit. That's not all he does by any means, but he does pull it out fairly often.
I don't even know if that's an Elvis thing. I think it's,
I don't know if it's intentional. I'm joking about it. I'm sure it's not intentionally an Elvis impression, but he does sound
more
a lot like Elvis.
Like the growl or whatever he was doing on Even Flow, which, I mean, even on the album.
Not even Even Flow, that's true. Elvis thing, I'm thinking more Alive.
Right.
He does really an Elvis thing.
Hey, I always thought Alive was a lot more Morrison than Elvis, but you could easily mix the two.
Really six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yes.
You know, Elvis, Morrison, Danzig, Vedder. It kind of goes downhill. It kind of comes down that way.
I've always liked, I mean, this is just a little intro, of course. It's a quiet little ballad. I mean, he kind of gets a little bit under the surface on it. Which is really all this is about. This song is just about, I mean, what's under the surface, and you know, where do you? I mean, the concepts on this album are very simple about fitting in,
and it's nice and mellow. Got some atonal, either piano or high guitar. I couldn't really tell.
Like books upon the many on the shelf. It was a great. He has some great lines on this album.
And Under the Surface is an interesting way of putting it, because it ends with these water effects.
Yeah.
But before that, it builds nicely. It just, you know, starts very mellow, builds up, and then drops down again. It's just a nice ride. Doesn't really have a clear verse chorus sort of a thing.
No. Of course, that quietness is just there to really set up.
On to track two, Hail Hell.
And the only song that really would fit in on the other earlier Pearl Jam albums here.
A couple of them got heavy, but I'm glad they went heavy on this next track.
Yeah.
Although I think the vocals are a little low in the mix.
Yeah.
And the Neil Young influence is so clear on this one.
Oh, yeah. There's something in your history you left out. Before this album, the band... worked with Neil Young.
Oh, I
Vedder did
that.
Not, but they worked on Neil Young's album called Mirror Ball from 95.
Okay, yeah, vaguely remember that. Yeah.
So it was Pearl Jam with Neil Young. In fact, like Red Mosquito is about him getting food poisoning and being trapped in a hotel room that we do later. But the thing with that was he had food poisoning while trying to do a show. Oh. And he could only make it through about like seven songs before he had to tap out.
Right.
Neil Young replaced him and finished the show.
Oh, wow.
So they were hanging out with Neil Young a lot to, you know, to get this influence on them.
There are four distinct influences on this album that I'll call out as we go.
Yeah.
Neil is the most obvious because they've worn that on their sleeves. The whole grunge thing. Every grunge artist bowed to Neil Young.
They do a fucking amazing cover of Rocket in the Free World, by the way.
Yeah, they do.
One that I got to see with the fireworks display going from like across the river. It was fucking phenomenal.
And Hell Hell has a nice slide guitar on the left. I don't know who's on left or right. I'm not familiar.
Yeah, it's hard to figure that out. Who's playing what?
I think the groove is a little repetitive. Yeah. If I have one criticism of Pearl Jam, it's they like to get into these grooves and just carry them on kind of endlessly.
Like, you have one guitar player here, though, playing a funk song, and another guitar player playing a southern rock song at the same time.
And there's a brief timing change in the second half that's very welcome before they go back to that same old groove. On to track three, Who You Are. And because of dyslexia, I initially had a joke about the Who in here. I had to listen to the song before I realized it wasn't Who Are You.
You know what? I think, didn't Spotify have it listed as Who Are You now?
They might have. I don't know.
It's Who You Are, yeah.
It's Who You Are, but I'm dyslexic, so I saw Who Are You. Really nice percussion in the opening. Again, more atonal guitar and bass. That's something they do really nice is that mellow kind of atonal space sounds.
Yeah. So Hail Hail should have been the lead single on this album, you know, like before the album came out.
Yeah, it would have brought them back, some of the old fans.
Right. Instead, they went with this as their lead singer, as the lead single, which of course confounded everyone.
Because they were openly hostile to their reputation.
Yes. Choosing this as a lead single is obviously a very anti-pop statement.
I kind of get that. When you have two guys from the band who basically wrote all the music on the first album, and it had one specific sound, and now the other two guys are writing, and they're going in a very different direction. You do want to showcase that we're doing something different now.
Well, also, I mean, I guess it even makes sense in a commercial standpoint, too, because, I mean, Nirvana wasn't going to make it out of the early 90s anyway.
No.
Like, I mean, they were pretty close to breaking up when Cobain killed himself. I mean, so you could either stay and try to live in that time period, or he could move on. They were trying to move on to at least function.
and I will say my criticisms are not coming from an objective standpoint. Musically, they are good at what they do. It's just personal taste. And I think that's a little derivative, and we'll get into that on this one, because here I noticed an influence I had not previously. And I think this is mostly limited to Eddie Vedder. He reminded me a lot of Springsteen on this one.
Oh, I didn't think of that.
I hear a lot of Springsteen in their stuff.
I couldn't in this song. I would think more of a Stones or Beatles thing that they were really going for here, like a late 60s.
Because it starts with that really psychedelic atonal thing with the big kind of tribal percussion.
Yes.
And then it gets very folky. Vedder, and this made me realize why I'm not a huge Pearl Jam fan. Because there's one song that the one song I added to my library, which we'll get to, that is a break from this. But Vedder is a folk singer. Vedder is a folk and country singer in a rock band. Rhythmically, he approaches things in a very folky kind of way. He focuses on the one, and it's all about kind of vehicles to get the lyrics out.
Yeah, because I couldn't see Springsteen singing about, you know, transcendental discovery.
Not necessarily in terms of the lyrics. This is my first time hearing the album, as I mentioned last time. If it's my first time hearing the album, I'm not really going to understand, pick up on a lot of the lyrics. But just in terms of his melodic and rhythmic choices, Vedder, and even his tone on this one is very Springsteen.
I think he does a number of styles.
When I say Springsteen, I mean Springsteen's kind of folk Euroacoustic stuff. I definitely hear a strong influence of that.
I could see them. I mean, he's covered Jersey Girl and everything. I mean, of course, he was in Jersey when he did that, but you know.
and this one really is a vehicle for the lyrics.
Yeah.
The music is just kind of, for the most part, the music is just kind of repetitive. Nice to hear again, Amit playing fretless. And then there's an instrumental break That's Indian.
Yes.
It goes very hippie.
Yeah.
Because this album is also very psychedelic in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Very 60s influenced. There's some nice vocal harmonies in there, which is not a thing I expect from Pearl Jam. On to track four, In My Tree. Again, nice tribal opening. Jack Iron's work with the Chili Peppers really did not show off that he could do this.
Yeah.
But also they really like their droning parts. And I don't mean drone in the sense of like one note that rings. But they get into a groove and they stick with it.
Right. And you get, I mean, in case you missed the whole tribal effect they were going for, they really sort of hit you over the head with it here. It's kind of neat how they do that in this album, where you get like hints of things here and there, and then like in a later song, they really put it in the center of attention, of course.
And the verse has this nice kind of lifting anthemic feel.
Yeah.
That the chorus really delivers on. And then there's this nice chanting section, which again, Indian kind of 60s hippie thing.
It's kind of weird because they have like this whole tribal primitive sound, but then they put like a shuffle in there with it.
Yeah.
Like you don't expect to hear those two styles together.
I posted to promote this episode, you know, on our social media, a live version of this with an organ solo that I was really disappointed wasn't on the studio version. Because the organ solo reminds me of Spock's beard.
Wow.
It reminds me a lot of a organ solo that Rio took in at the end of the day from V.
They've had a keyboard player tour with them for a really long time. I forget his name though. Mm-hmm. Looks like Billy Connolly.
Yeah, I've seen he's in the video, yeah.
He's been touring with them for like 15 years at more than that probably. I think he's been like 20 years.
And I have to give this album one thing. I can't predict what's coming next.
No. No, you cannot. It is very eclectic.
Also, for a band where the guitars are dominant, they're also really understated.
Well, it was always a misnomer to call them grunge. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just kind of something they got stuck with being from where they were from coming out.
Well, like, I mean, none of the big grunge bands weren't grunge.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, Soundgarden was a metal band.
Yeah. So was Alice.
Nirvana was a punk band.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam is whatever psychedelic. I don't know what to call them.
Yes, it is. Pearl Jam and Alice both have the same thing where it's like they made their own sounds pretty much. Both of like they both bands. It's like, okay, that's a Pearl Jam album, you know,
On to track five, Smile. Now, the music on this one was written entirely by Jeff Ament, the only one case where he wrote the music on his own. And this is by far my favorite.
Oh. Did I mention the band had just worked with Neil Young?
it's very, well, it's just got this nice loose groove. It's got the strongest groove of any song on the album. And it's got harmonica, which would normally annoy me, but it fits for some reason.
Oh, it does. And I, you know what? This made me like look at the lyrics and like, what the hell is he talking about sort of thing. I don't know if you got to see the story either, but apparently it's somebody just wrote him a note with these words on it pretty much.
Oh, okay.
And ended the note with, three crooked heart swirls. Huh. So he's literally just singing the note.
Okay. Wow.
I think it's a guy for the band called the Frogs that told him he missed me already or something.
And like you said, Neil Young, this is the most Neil Young song on the album.
Oh yeah. Oh
and
yeah.
In definitely. The best way.
Yeah.
It's noisy and has a great groove and it's just fun. And yeah, it has this nice anthemic chorus. And the harmonica is a bit off key, which just fits because the song is just ragged.
Yeah.
The great kind of ragged guitar solos. I respect the rest of what I'd heard up to this point, but this is the first song that I really liked on it.
It's one of my starred songs from it too.
On to track six, Off He Goes. This is a nice place for a ballad after you get this, you know, the most conventional rock song on the album. And emotionally, it just kind of works, you know, even though it's a stark contrast, you know, in terms of overall sound.
Honestly, I'm not sure why this one never received airplay, because this is a very...
And they did a video for this one.
They did?
Yeah, when I was looking to post a video, I ended up going with a live one, but because this song just didn't grab me. That's the thing. In isolation, when I watched the video, this song didn't grab me. In context, after a smile, it really works.
I didn't know they made a video.
I'll send you a link after we finish.
I thought they did not make any videos between Jeremy and Evolution from Yield,
they,
I think.
They did one for this, and I think they did a couple of others that I found for this.
Or is this them performing somewhere? Or?
No, it was a conceptual video.
Really? Wow, I did not know that. Because I remember when Evolution came out, it was like this big deal that Pearl Jam made a video.
And in this one, Vedder is really channeling Springsteen.
Yeah.
To me, he sounds he really is going for the Springsteen sound.
I can see that here.
Because, you know, Springsteen has that raw, growly kind of, not even growl in the sense of, you know, like he does on Even Flow, but it's just that hoarse, big sound that Springsteen has that Vedder also kind of has at times.
He has, but his voice is definitely more diverse than Springsteen's.
Well, yeah, well, of course. I'm saying that
Springsteen does like one thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Vedder has a lot more range and has a much better voice than Springsteen has. I'm just saying Springsteen was a clear influence. I'm realizing Springsteen was a clear influence on him.
Yeah, I could see that, though.
And this has a really nice build at verse two. There's some kind of pedal steel sounding guitar. I don't think it's an actual pedal steel. And this is the point where the album was starting to grow on me. Although this one does drag a bit, I think it's a little too long.
Like, the meaning of this song is kind of up for debate. Like, some people speculate it could be about Cobain, because it's like their first album since his suicide.
Okay.
And the end sounds a lot like the Unplugged All Apologies, too.
Okay, yeah.
But I don't know. I don't think they were really that close, honestly, the two of them.
On to track seven. Habit.
It's really interesting to put that after Smile, actually, though, if you think about it, because they're both about missing someone, you know, someone not being present in your life. So,
and musically, like I said, they're very different, but it works for some reason.
Yeah.
On to track seven, Habit. Again, they needed to get loud.
It's a Pearl Jam tradition, I think, that's lasted all the way into the last couple of albums where they do some, at least one punk-inspired song.
Well, there are two on this one.
Yes, there's
two. But it's kind of been their version of loud, or soft, loud, soft.
Yeah.
Instead of doing it in the same song, and you know, like the Pixies, they do it on an album.
Right.
This is just a shouty mid-tempo punk song. Yeah, it's a nice riff, largely a vehicle for the lyrics.
I believe it's just Vedder shouting at MacReady, honestly.
Okay. Because it was a nice groove until the vocals came in.
I think it was MacReady who had alcoholism was getting him. And so it's literally Vedder just shouting at him.
Okay, he's a kind of ruined the groove for me when the vocals came in, but yeah, it makes sense for Vedder. And I'm saying Vedder ruins the grooves on these songs. Thing is, I like his solo album, when he plays ukulele.
Oh yeah,
I really like that album. Because there's no band to disrupt. It's just him, you know, off in his own world, and it works. And plus, I'm a ukulele player, so it was interesting to hear what he does with the instrument. So got some nice riffs back to a habit.
It's a bit long for a punk song.
Yeah, it's got some kind of nice shouted harmonies.
Punk song should be 2 minutes and you're out, you know. They go for like 3.5.
But then it gets weird.
Oh, yeah. They just break down and...
Speaking as a child of the 90s, he says, spoken in the middle of the song.
Yes,
or toward the end. Child of the 90s?
I remember he did the Kids of Today Should Defend Themselves Against the 70s song. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, these guys are like a few years older than us, maybe 5 to 10 years older than us.
And this is, you know, you can't be a child of the 90s in 96.
We're children of the 80s.
Yeah, pretty much.
If they're children of the 80s, maybe the 70s. Because I'm not real sure how old they are. I think they're a little bit older than us.
Just a little, yeah, a little older. Not much.
But, you know, that line just caught me off guard. made no sense.
I think it was a little bit of a joke.
And then there's this great noisy Neil Young kind of instrumental section.
Yeah.
On to track 8, Red Mosquito. This is where it started to fall apart for me.
Oh yeah. Well, they you heard accents of Southern rock in earlier songs. Now they go full out Southern rock.
This one they just couldn't make up their minds, because it starts with this nice kind of bluesy Hendrixy kind of groove,
which I learned he played with a Zippo.
Interesting. Some nice kind of, again, nice lead guitar, Barry Hendrix. And then it just gets mellow and folky.
Yeah, it's a very, you know, folk song kind of Southern rock.
And if it just started there and went folky and was a folk song, great. But then it goes back to the kind of Hendrixy thing, and then back to the folky section. They just couldn't make up their minds, and it is a bit too long and derivative. This is where I realize that Vedder's a folk singer.
Yeah, this is definitely, I could see how you'd get a folk out of this, because I mean, it is Southern rock folk. He's telling this weird story too.
Well, yeah.
With Fred Mosquito.
And it, like I said, it just goes on a little too long, and the two different sides just don't really mesh at all.
They've had some great guests play the guitar on this, you know, some slide guitar and everything live.
Onto track 9, Lucan, and this is the one I actually looked up the lyrics for, because I had to know what the title was. Lucan is Eddie Vedder's friend Matt Lucan of Mudhoney and the Melvins.
Oh, okay.
And it's just a simple, straightforward, angry punk song about a bad night. The other, one of the influences I hadn't brought up yet that I definitely hear in them, I mean, punk is a big influence, but specifically The Damned.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of different punk acts you could, you know, pull from, but they do seem to be influenced by The Damned a lot. This is another one of my favorites. It's just this great change after Red Mosquito. Some nice.
They still play this live, like leading right into Not For You from Vitalogy.
Just nice distorted bass and just aggressive, and could not get any louder, or could not go any longer. It just works. And I like how it ends very abruptly with him talking about this delusional fan who showed up at his house and claimed that he raped and impregnated her. And how first off, the first verse is he loses his key. So he goes off to his friend Lucan's place, somehow finds his key. No, he just goes there and eats and comes back, and the door's open. And there's this delusional fan there who claims that he raped and impregnated her. And then it ends with him saying that delusional fan is going to go get a gun.
Well, remember, he had a fan try to kill him.
Right.
Like drive their car into his house.
Yeah, sort of thing. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, so it's a serious business. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that was when they decided, you know what, this Stardom thing, it's not that good. Not really fucking worth it.
Right.
We could make music we want to make and not have everybody listen to us and follow every move, but yeah, we'll just do our own thing.
And I just like that it's this loud, angry song about a really bad night. And then the chorus is, I'm going to Lucan's. Because, you know, you open the fridge and, you know, I know what life is worth. Can go to my friend's house and eat or drink. On to track 10, Present Tense.
Now we're back to the opening themes about the fitting in and finding your place in the world. And
nice and trippy in the beginning and mellow. Vedder has like 3 or 4 melodies that he recycles.
I'm trying to think.
And this is the Springsteen one. Because this is another one that really reminds me of Springsteen. But I like how the guitar develops throughout it. Nice build to the chorus. Because the verses did get a bit monotonous.
I would say this is some of his strongest vocals, actually, on the album, in this one.
Not necessarily in terms of his sound. You know, he doesn't sound like Springsteen, but the melody is a bit Springsteen-y.
Yeah.
This is kind of stock Pearl Jam mellow rock song. I was happy to hear the drums kick in the last third, though. Ended this nice little instrumental section with some lead bass. That part woke me up, and it just builds to this nice cacophony.
Yeah, they do the soft to loud here, actually. Yeah, which they really don't do very often, actually. Yeah.
Because probably Nirvana was doing enough of that, and they said, "Okay, let that be. Yeah, they can be the ones to rip off the Pixies."
but I wouldn't say the Pixies would do something like this. This is more of a prog influence, yeah. Actually, probably.
I was just Nirvana, obviously ripping off the Pixies.
And, yeah,
you know, they Pearl Jam avoided that because Nirvana was already doing that.
Well, yeah, the difference between the two: Nirvana took heavily from one source, whereas Pearl Jam took from many sources, and they freely admit that they're many sources too.
The other one, and I think fits on this one for you know, mellow rock song, is the Velvet Underground.
I can see that.
I hear a lot of Velvet. It's basically Nirvana to me, or Pearl Jam, sorry, to me, is Neil Young, Springsteen, Young and Springsteen meet in CBGBs. You know, so you've got some Velvet Underground and some Damned in there too. On to track 11, Mankind, another favorite.
A diss track to Stone Temple Pilots.
The lyrics and the lead vocals on this one are by Stone Gossard. Really nice change of pace to hear, you know, and not a typical Pearl Jam song.
No.
And another vocalist. You know, I got to give Vedder a lot of credit. He's definitely knows how to use his voice to the fullest potential. But it's nice to hear somebody else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was just a really nice palate cleanser. I'm wondering if he sang the octave up too, because there's two vocals.
Yeah.
He sings, you know, normal vocal, and then there's one singing along an octave up.
Yeah, I wonder if he backed it.
If he did that, because I don't think that's Vedder. I don't think he could quite get up there for somebody else in the band. Just get a nice classic alt rock groove.
Because I believe Inadvertent Imitation is how Stone Temple Pilots explain sounding so much like everyone else, including Pearl Jam.
And this one reminds me a bit of Bob Mould.
Yes, oh, very much so.
I've been getting into a lot recently.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, this is very Bob Mould. And it's nothing groundbreaking. It's just nice and fun. And you said
this
it
could
was
have been a huge hit
if they
a single.
You said it was a diss track. I didn't pay any attention to the lyrics.
And a lot of the lyrics, like, it's kind of like images of masturbation. You know, if you really pay attention, like the magazine, but they're just like off a little bit. Instead of Vaseline, he says Ovaltine.
Okay.
Something about sinking a battleship too. Is kind of a vibrator.
Okay, to me it just kind of felt like random lyrics in this kind of up-tempo, you know, classic alt rock song that was just fun.
But yeah, it's a definite call out to Weiland and the Company.
On to track 12, I'm Open, another favorite. This is just nicely weird.
Yes, some trippy guitar, a lot of this on Vitology.
Some trippy guitar and spoken vocals.
Vitology, they've got a song with an accordion.
Nice. And the music is just kind of nicely new agey. And then by new age, I mean the music, not the spiritual thing. Lots of high sound effects, probably guitars. Just a complete change of pace that I think the album needed a lot.
It wraps up the themes of the album, too. You know, just about that isolation, childhood.
Yeah.
There's so much about childhood on this album and just navigating your way through life and the world.
I have to admit, I don't really care for the criticism of rationality. He talks about a kid who thought, you know, the stars were magical, and as he grew up, he learned how things actually work. And he kind of says, like, he regretted, you know, becoming rational.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you've got it, but once you get it, you can't lose it.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. There's no trade backs, and you've got to move forward.
And the spoken vocals come back. I just like how trippy it is.
I think present tense kind of fits in that too, you know, where it's like you can't go by your past failures. You can't beat yourself up with them. Like, that was a MacReady song, I think, by the way, present tense. That wasn't a Vedder song.
Well, yeah. Well, he wrote all of the lyrics up. Vedder wrote all of the lyrics up except for Mankind.
Oh, I thought present tense was MacReady.
Vedder wrote all of the lyrics except for that one. The music is all over the place with, you know, all the band members writing different things. On to track 13, finally, Around the Bend.
I think I think I'm going with this one as my favorite, actually.
Really? Okay. I don't know if I'd say I have a weakest. Maybe, you know, I'm not going to pick out a weakest.
I think by default, I'm Open gets the weakest because it's not really a song. It's okay, more of a meditation more than anything else.
This one just kind of felt Eagles to me.
Oh, it's just a lullaby.
It's just this mellow 70s ballad.
I wouldn't even put a time to it. I mean...
Well, the vocals are kind of 50s-ish.
Hush, little baby, you know? I mean, it's right, you know? There is no time to it.
I've noticed, on this one, I've said nice a lot in this review, which says a lot about my feelings on this album. It just goes on too long for a nice, simple, but kind of derivative song for me.
I think it's like only 2 minutes.
Midway through, I started to get bored and was hoping for this abrupt change that never happened.
No, it's like, it is 3 minutes. Or no. Oh, you're right. It's 4.5. But, it's literally just a lullaby written to Jack Iron's newborn.
Okay.
To sing to him asleep. And if you think about it, after you leave all the baggage behind with I'm Open and all the other things they're talking about, you're just left with this innocence and purity. Although some people suggest that he did it as an exercise, and there you could also say it's a serial killer singing to his victims, but I refuse to believe that.
I prefer the story about Jack Iron's kid.
Yeah, I think so too.
Would you recommend it? Obviously, you chose this one, so
definitely. I think this is Pearl Jam at their best, without a doubt. I mean, it's eclectic, yet there's still a very coherent message. And they go to places you'd never think they would have gone to, you know? You really wouldn't have pegged them as a Southern rock band or anything like that, yet they go there. And, I think it's tough to pick your favorite because there's so many on here.
I'm really on the fence, like you were with Fresh D'Amico. If you like Pearl Jam, you'll like this album.
Oh, I don't even know about that because there's a lot of Pearl Jam fans
that do not like this album. There are.
See, 10... And Verses were, you know, the casual fans' albums. Verses was very derivative of 10 because the record company forced them to make that.
I have to give it another listen. I just only know the singles, and they were a little too mellow for me.
But I mean, I've started, this is in my library. I've got Hail, Hail, Who You Are, In My Tree, Smile, and Around the Bend on my list.
Yeah, if you like Pearl Jam, maybe. I think if you don't have time to listen to Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, The Damned, and The Velvet Underground, they package it all together nicely.
It's a great mix of them, actually. I think those are artists that are worth mixing.
I'm going to go undecided on this one, like you did with PTM. It's fine. It's just nothing special to me. And this is all subjective taste. If this were a movie on Zombie Takeout, I'd probably give it a 3.5. Yeah. I like it, but I just... but I'll go on the fence instead of a full-on non-recommendation.
I think there are too many great songs to miss to not hear this. And they weren't 90s staples, I think if you're looking for 90s music that you haven't heard, aside from Hail Hail, there's a lot of songs on here that have not been played.
And like I said, a lot of it has to do with me with Pearl Jam, but their later stuff that I have heard, I've realized it's how Vedder approaches the rhythm that throws me off.
I think their latest few albums, they're just too comfortable. Because they need someone to push them out of their comfort zone.
The reason I like Smile so much is that solid groove. And I was going through it tonight and realizing the way Vedder comes in rhythmically throws off that groove. You know, keeps it from that solid 2-4 groove that rock tends to have, which, you know, maybe if you like that, great. It's just that loses my interest a bit.
I think they go off kilter from traditional rock, at least back then. I think now they put together just more traditional, straightforward songs.
I'll have to check out some of their newer stuff.
I kind of bored with it, though. kind of worries easily, I think.
I'm also one of those casual fans who you mentioned who likes 10.
I think their last really good album was their self-titled. Mm-hmm. And usually my theory has always been if a band has a self-titled album that is not a debut album, that usually means after that they're out of ideas.
Fair. That's it for No Code by Pearl Jam. Until next time, we'll be reviewing Darling Violetta, Parlor by Darling Violetta. The first half of a two-parter. It's their last album, and also the guitar player released a solo album around the same time, so gonna put them together. They're both kind of interesting. Until then, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.